Well, welcome listeners and supporters to this edition of our Outside View. I'm really excited to talk with today's guest, Rob Stone. According to his intro, I'm going to read it. This is all the things that he does. He's a grandfather, a gardener, a doctor. He lives in the woods north of Bloomington with his wife, Karen Greenstone. Born and raised in Evansville, Indiana, and graduated from Dartmouth College and the University of Colorado Medical School. He's long been a passionate advocate for universal health care and is the director of Medicare for All Indiana, as well as on the board of advisors for Physicians for a National Health Program. He used to do his doctoring, I like the way you put that, in the ER at Bloomington Hospital, but since 2011 has practiced hospice and palliative care. He believes that we will someday have affordable health care for everyone, and the sooner the better. Welcome, Rob.
Welcome. Glad to be here.
It's also nice to see you again. I remember we talked about some of these issues several years ago on Blooming Out, and I'm very frustrated. I have to say that not much has changed since that conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And, I read all these things, and as I age, I am concerned because costs seem to be rising, continue mm-hmm. to rise. And so I don't know what's going to happen here in the future. I mean, you say you believe it's really going to happen. And some people say Medicare, some people say Medicaid.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's other people who want to keep the option of, private, people want their own insurance,
right.
Which I don't understand that at
yeah.
all. I think they don't understand the concept of a broader scope of Medicare treatment, like mm-hmm. in Canada and mm-hmm. other countries that have done it quite successfully.
Yeah.
So what do you see? What's happening? What's preventing this besides the big corporations, the pharmaceutical industry, the medical industry, the insurance companies?
Mm-hmm.
How do
mm-hmm.
we get them out of the way?
right. So I think what you're saying about that you haven't seen much change
right.
refers to what people are experiencing on the ground or in their homes, in their lives.
Exactly.
And it's true. Not much has changed, and if anything, things just continue to get worse.
I know Obamacare was promising, but it doesn't, of course, go far enough. And, of course, everybody's
right.
undermining it all the time.
Right. So Obamacare, now that has been 10 years ago when we had the Obamacare debate in 2009. And then it went into law in 2010. And at that time, there were 50 million some people uninsured. And now there are about 30 million people uninsured. So there's 20 million people who got coverage. Less than half of the uninsured got covered, but 20 million people got coverage, mostly not through buying insurance on the Obamacare exchanges, but through expanding Medicaid in the states that expanded Medicaid. And Indiana, some of you may remember, originally when Pence was governor, he said he would never expand Medicaid
right.
under Obamacare, which
exactly.
sounds so terrible. But he did, partly because of grassroots work from organizations like ours that helped to provide some kind of political impetus or cover or something. So Indiana expanded Medicaid. It's called HIP, Healthy Indiana Plan. I forget how many people got coverage under HIP. I think it was 700,000 or something like a sizable number of people.
Mm-hmm.
So for those people who had no coverage before, they see real benefit because they got covered under Obamacare. Some people, there was a significant but much smaller number of people who got coverage through the exchanges. But in the meantime, the number of uninsured did dip down nationally to about 28 million. Now it's crept back up to about 30 million. And the Trump administration's been doing everything it can to undermine the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare. But it's a really interesting thing to think about because what's going to happen in the future? That's what we're going to talk
exactly.
about next. And no one, let me back up. First of all, no one, as far as I could tell, predicted that Bernie Sanders would win the Indiana primary over Hillary Clinton.
That's true.
That was very surprising. Nobody thought that Donald Trump would win the Republican nomination. And then no one thought, well, a few people thought, but most of the people who seemed to think they knew what they were talking about did not think he would win the presidency. And there's a strong argument to be made that he didn't even think he was going to win the
presidency. He didn't win the presidency, let's face it.
Well, he became president, right?
Yes.
He won the contest, maybe not, but he didn't. Yeah, there's questions about the vote. But even more astounding in terms of what the political people who thought they knew what they were talking about, even more astounding than Trump's becoming president is that after Trump became president, absolutely nobody thought the Affordable Care Act would still be standing here in 2019. Nobody thought that was possible. And yet, the Affordable Care Act is still here. It's been weakened. Although some states have added the Medicaid expansion. And so it's just hard to predict the future. That's what
I'm trying to say. Well, don't you think it's I hear a lot of people say, well, I know people that lost their insurance under the Affordable Care Act, and they weren't happy when they don't have insurance and all that. And I'm thinking, but perhaps, I guess we're not reaching all the people as far as education goes. And education, I mean very broadly. I don't necessarily mean we have to talk to just people that went to university and have a PhD. But the general public, they don't understand. I said, well, you're supposed to go online. And you're supposed to do a little research and find a plan that works for you and your family.
Yeah.
And I think people didn't do that. They just dropped it. They just let it go. And then they go to the emergency room, which ultimately ends up costing all of us a lot more money.
For sure. For sure.
So I think we're not reaching everybody. I think and government's falling down on that. And don't you think that's lobbying from the pharmaceutical companies and insurance companies? They're going to lose a lot if we
That's a big part of it. And I just want to make sure people understand one thing, too, is that the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare was never designed to cover everybody. It was always predicted that even when fully implemented, there'd be 20 million uninsured. So it was never a plan to really take care of everybody. But what's happened in the meantime is that people who do have insurance are continuing to find their copays and deductibles go up. People without insurance are finding insurance to be medical care to be totally a ticket to bankruptcy. And the overall problem on the ground then has gotten worse over the last few years. But on the other hand, the idea that we could expand Medicare to cover everybody, that we could have what we used to refer to as a single payer plan, but now we pretty much just call it Medicare for all. The idea, you know, in the last election, that was a crazy talk idea. That was a far communist leftist idea, and now everybody's talking about it. Everybody's talking about it, and in fact, all the people running for president on the Democratic side in the primaries, all of them who are in the Senate have signed on to Bernie Sanders' bill, which is the Senate bill that would give us a universal Medicare for all system. Now, having said that, several of them, like Kamala Harris and Cory Booker, have, although they've signed on as co-sponsors of that bill, they have now subsequently backed off. And in fact, most of the Democrats running have backed off, except for Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders. And they're talking about these kind of watered-down versions of some kind of step beyond the Affordable Care Act. But this still keeps the private insurance industry involved.
I know, and I think that's a problem. People want that public option, and I don't think they understand. Like the really very, very wealthy, maybe that 1%, 2%, or 3% at the top, they don't even have insurance. They don't care. They don't need it. They just pay for everything. They just go in and here's the money. But it's everybody else underneath that has to have insurance. Mm-hmm. And I think they don't realize, they're afraid, I can't choose my doctor. I can't choose this. Mm-hmm. I can't choose that. People are so worried about choice. I have found in the last couple of years, now I'm 74, and I've been using asthma medication my whole life. Right? Years and years and years ago, maybe 40 years ago, I used an inhaler that I didn't even have to get a prescription for. And I used it because the doctor said, this is how much you use it, and I followed that direction. It was really simple, and it cost $5. Well, now I just paid $290 for three inhalers that they're not the same one, but they're also a prescription. You know, and I can't be trusted to, I guess, to take my own medication. And those people who over-medicate, they're going to do that anyway. They're going to. The opioid crisis is an example of that. I mean, I've taken painkillers, but I didn't become, an addict and there's lots of reasons for addictive behavior. But people are not educated, I don't think, to feel confident in getting medical information mm-hmm. from a source, a good mm-hmm. source, following it mm-hmm. and trusting it.
Mm-hmm.
I think we've fallen down in that area. And so now I think people don't understand public option. They don't understand Medicaid. Mm-hmm. They don't understand Medicare.
Mm-hmm.
They think it's all socialism. Mm-hmm. You know, you've got to pay or you'll have socialism.
Mm-hmm. So shall I talk about that a little?
Yes, yes. How does the Canadian system work, for instance, or some of the other countries, like in the Netherlands, and I think England even has a, don't mm-hmm. they have a healthcare system that's a little more effective or not?
Mm-hmm.
I have heard they do. But.
You're giving me a lot of questions here. So I guess I need to know from you where you want me to focus, because we've got a lot of stuff on the table here.
Well, I guess educating people on what our options are mm-hmm. and what people are afraid of, and then what's blocking all this mm-hmm. from going through and changing.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. So right now we have this crazy quilt patched together, complicated and inefficient system, inefficient and unfair. And so we have Medicare, which, just to make it clear, is different from Medicaid. Medicare is the government program that takes care of everybody once they turn age 65, and some disabled people and some other things, people on dialysis. But Medicare is a universal program. Once you turn 65, mm-hmm. you're eligible for Medicare. Doesn't matter about pre-existing conditions or whatever. Then another really big government program is Medicaid, and Medicaid is a program designed for poor people. It has income requirements, eligibility requirements, and it is a program that is really a lifesaver for a lot of people who can't afford health insurance and don't have a lot of money. But it is also a program that puts up a lot of barriers to care, because some physicians, some hospitals won't take Medicaid. And then there's private insurance, which is, you know, Anthem Blue Cross, Humana, United Healthcare, those sorts of things. And most of the private insurance in this country is provided through employer-based insurance. Then there's the VA, the Indian Health Service, other pieces, but there are all these different pieces. So Medicare already takes care of us old people. I'm 67. I'm on Medicare.
I am too.
So we Medicare recipients are luckily, you and I look like we're in pretty good health, but in our age bracket are the sickest, most complicated, and therefore the most expensive mm-hmm. people. And Medicare has been taking care of the most complicated, most expensive people for over 50 years. So it's a proven entity. It runs overhead of about 2%. And it is a very, very popular program. It does a great job. That's why we say, Physicians for National Health Program, which is the national organization I'm involved in, and Medicare for All Indiana, which is the state organization. We say, let's use the model of Medicare. I think Medicare could use some improvements, mm-hmm. But it needs to be improved, but also expanded, because it's a proven entity. It's an American solution. It's not some foreign idea, and it's not some kind of communist idea. It is a government program. Just like the government takes care of sewage and trash pickup. I mean, are those communist plots that we trust the government to take care of sewage and trash, take care of public education and the police and the fire departments? There are some things the government actually can do pretty well, and they do Medicare pretty well, and it's a proven fact. Now, who opposes this? Well, the private insurance industry, the for-profit private insurance industry, Anthem, Humana, United Healthcare, Cigna, so on, they take care of the largest number of people in the country. So they take care of more people than Medicare takes care of. They take care of more people than Medicaid takes care of. But the people they take care of are, like I said, it's primarily through employers. And so the private insurance industry primarily takes care of people who are the healthiest segment of the whole population, the least expensive segment of the population. So that's an important thing to remember, that private insurance industry has gotten, is very happy that the government takes care of the poor people and the government takes care of the old people, because who they want to take care of, they want to take care of healthy people. And why is that?
Well, because they can take all the premiums and make money and they don't have to, you know, refund much.
Well, exactly. So so an insurance company is, most of the insurance in the United States is for profit. And how does the insurance company make profit? Well, it's very simple. They want to take in premiums, that's their income, and they want to, as much as possible, not pay out when people get sick.
Absolutely. They're hard to deal with sometimes. Now, I have both. I have a combination, United and ARP Medicare.
Mm-hmm. Right. So you've got Medicare with a supplement. Mm-hmm. But most of the people who we talk about in the system have insurance that's private insurance, but it is insurance that that's provided by your employer. But those insurance companies are making money, and remember, how are they being profitable? They're being profitable by taking in your premiums, whether it's your employer paying the premiums or yourself paying in the premiums, but then they have to limit their expenses, which means they work really hard to try to find ways to not pay for care. So they deny coverage. They try very hard not to actually take care of people who might get sick. So they
invest the money too, probably. And
they invest the money
too.
Their
investments. I mean, look at the buildings they build for themselves.
So the point I want to make, though, is that I went to medical school to take care of sick people. The for-profit insurance companies exist. They become profitable. They serve their shareholders by finding out ways to not take care of sick people, by figuring out ways to not pay for health care.
It's the opposite philosophy.
Exact opposite. So the insurance companies got to go. And the insurance companies are the primary reason, not the only reason, but the primary reason why in health in the United States, even though we leave 30 million people uninsured and no other modern developed country does that, we have terrible healthcare statistics, but we have the most expensive healthcare in the world. We pay about twice as much as the Canadians do for healthcare.
Okay, so this organization that you're involved with, Physicians for a National Health Program, what steps are you taking? What is underway to try to, how does one eliminate this big insurance infrastructure? Mm-hmm. It's amazing. Mm-hmm. It's powerful.
Right. So there's policy and there's politics. And those are very different things. So in terms of policy, there is a plan that was worked out started with a plan initially formulated by Ted Kennedy when he was a senator from Massachusetts, and then further developed by Representative Conyers from Detroit when he was in the House of Representatives. And it's called the Expanded and Improved Medicare for All, which was in the House of Representatives for many years, and now very similar. So now it's Representative Jayapal from Seattle who is sponsoring this bill in the House, and then Bernie Sanders has a very similar bill in the Senate. So we've worked it out. We've worked out how to do it in terms of how to make the transition, how to reimburse the insurance companies for lost income, in terms of how to reemploy insurance industry people who might well lose their jobs, because there would probably be a significant number of people who currently work in the insurance industry or servicing the insurance industry who would lose their jobs, who would need to be retrained and taken care of. And we've worked it out. Many, many, many economists have looked at this plan. In fact, recently there was a letter signed by, I think, 278 economists around the country saying we could do Medicare for all. It would cost less than we're paying right now, and it would cover everybody. And that's not funny numbers. That's not unicorns and wishful thinking. We could cover everybody for less than we're paying now. But the big requirement for that is we have to vastly downsize the role of these private insurance companies. There would still be some role for them, kind of like there is probably with, in terms of supplements and extra insurance. But the basic thing is we got to get rid of them, because while Medicare runs 2% overhead, the private insurance industry runs 20% overhead. And the complexity of billing means that with the private insurance companies, the billing that hospitals have to do, the billing that doctors have to do is vastly more expensive and complicated. So, but we could save a ton of money. We would have better health care, we'd have everybody covered.
Maybe
that's the policy.
Okay.
But the politics
that's
the big lift, because we're talking about vastly downsizing a very profitable industry, the private health insurance industry. And we're also talking about, how do we pay for this? How do we save money? We're also talking about putting some limits on drug companies' profits. They'd still be profitable. We're not talking about nationalizing the drug companies, but the drug companies have been making huge profits in the United States, more profit per person here than any other country. So they've got to pay for this somehow. So we've got to take out some of the greed, some of the profit, some of the wasted money in the current system, some of the inefficiency, so that everybody can get taken care of.
Well, maybe people would, I don't know how complicated this plan is. I know Ted Kennedy.
It's really simple.
I know Ted Kennedy, and I actually met him several years ago and then listened to him speak, and I always supported his initiatives. But, of course, he was one of the single little voices out in the forest trying to get this through, I remember at the time. But I think people don't understand, well, how would you do this, and what is it going to cost me?
Mm-hmm.
And so maybe if you could provide a little more insight into how this would be done.
Right, right.
And how it would affect the individual, the typical.
Right, how would it affect the individual? So, you know, of course, the great benefit for the individual is that everybody's going to be covered from birth to death. That's the greatest advantage. You don't have to worry about your insurance. You don't have to worry about the premiums. You don't have. We want to provide care that has minimal barriers, financial barriers to care. So we want to get rid of we want to get rid of premiums, copays, and deductibles, and we want to replace that with tax. So it means tax will go up. And that's a scary thing, and that kind of puts a little lump in people's heart. Ooh.
But it shouldn't if you're not paying all those other things.
Right. So how to pay for it is that we would have to increase taxes, but the premiums, deductibles, and copays would go away. And so there's a number of different ways to do this. And remember, it will cost less than it does now. Therefore, it's not that hard to do. But we would do things that would essentially mean that your payroll tax, for instance, might go up 5%. Your employer's payroll tax might go up 9%. But your employers wouldn't be paying for your insurance, and you wouldn't be paying for insurance. And we put maybe a tax on, Elizabeth Warren's talked about a net wealth tax for people who are worth more than $20 million. There might be a tiny tax of 0.023% on stock transactions. But the idea is that for the vast majority of people, they will come out ahead. But people making the breaking point's going to be somewhere between $250,000 and $300,000 a year family income. In other words, people making less than $250,000 to $300,000 a year family income should see their overall costs come down. People who are making $350,000, $400,000 up are going to pay more. So some people are going to pay more.
And who would they pay that to?
So it's going to be taxes.
Taxes.
So right now, you know, we pay for this with premiums. Mm-hmm. And basically the system is rigged so that people who are sicker one way or another end up paying more.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, we think a much fairer way, instead of having the sick pay for the lion's share of health care, is to have the wealthy pay for the lion's share of health care. And so it's a progressive tax. It's going to be an income tax or graduated tax sort of thing, so that wealthier people are going to pay more now overall than they paid before. They've gotten all the breaks for the last 20 years since Ronald Reagan was elected in terms of the tax cut. They've gotten all the breaks. They're going to have to give back a little bit of that. And then other people are going to pay less, and they're going to have the coverage, which is the wonderful thing.
Now, where does money for medical research, how is that going to be affected, or is it? And for drug research,
mm-hmm.
like these big companies like Eli Lilly and, you know, mm-hmm. all the others, where will their funding come from?
Okay, very good question. Because people worry, is this going to somehow stifle innovation?
Right.
So right now, most medical research is paid for by the government. National Institutes of Health, National Science Foundation, most research is funded by the government. That wouldn't change. And in fact, the other day, actually a couple weeks ago, on Noon Edition, the WFIU Friday radio call-in show, mm-hmm. on Noon Edition, a friend of mine, Dr. Ed Weisbart, who's a physicians for national, a PNHP, Physicians for National Health Program, physician from St. Louis, was on that show, along with a guy from Indianapolis who's doing research on ways to innovate and improve the delivery of healthcare in our system. Now, this guy, who my friend Ed was kind of debating with a little bit on the show, it's not really a debate show, it's a talk show, but this guy was talking about all these innovative ideas he's working on and this research he's doing, but he was a free market kind of guy. Mm-hmm. So Ed asked him, so who's funding your research? And he said, CMS. CMS stands for the Center for Medicare Services. Mm-hmm. In other words, the government is funding this guy's research. Private insurance companies aren't funding this kind of research. So the government already is funding research. Government funds a lot of pharmaceutical research. The pharmaceutical companies do some research, but the vast majority of the money they spend on research is when a new drug is created, usually with NIH money, and a company buys that and starts making it, then the drug companies spend a lot of their research money on what are called Me Too drugs. So when one company comes up with a new cholesterol drug, then the drug companies create 8 more cholesterol drugs. That's where a lot of their research goes. Mm-hmm. So the new drugs, the big drugs, are mostly developed with government money, and then the drug companies spend all their money on making these copycat drugs. And it's also important to remember the drug companies spend more money on advertising than they spend on research and development.
That doesn't surprise me. TV ads, for instance.
The TV ads are terrible.
They're really expensive, I can imagine.
Only the United States and New Zealand allow these kind of TV ads, and they're a bad idea.
I would prefer to get my advice from my doctor than I would from a TV ad. Mm-hmm. And I think that brings in a lot of people who think they have a lot of information, but they really don't.
Mm-hmm.
And you should always talk to I come from a medical
mm-hmm.
family. Almost everybody was in the medical field except me. So I've always supported the medical field. What about the CDC? Now, they do a lot of research. They're government funded too, aren't they, or are they?
Right. So the CDC, the Center for Disease Control in Atlanta, Georgia, is government funded, and they do great work, and they are primarily focused on infectious diseases, but they also study a lot of other public health issues and all of public health, our drinking water, that's the government protecting us. It all fits together.
I don't think people understand just mm-hmm. what the government actually does for us that's not communism.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
They don't, that word, like a communist under every rock, I remember mm-hmm. that from the 60s and 70s, and
right.
now it's back again, They don't understand what all the government does mm-hmm. for us. And then when you talk about, we're going to give up this so we can have this, mm-hmm. no, that's a communist plot.
Mm-hmm.
What other thing, what other things is your organization, your program doing? How are you going to achieve this?
Mm-hmm. So
what
our
steps
organization.
Are you taking?
So our organization, Physicians for a National Health Program, that stands for PNHP, our PNHP stands for that, and PNHP.org is a great, tremendous resource to go to that website, PNHP.org. So our group is a 501c3, which means that we are an educational organization, and so we do a lot of education, we fund research, it's basically focused on education. So we cannot endorse a candidate, but we can talk about ideas. Mm-hmm. So I can't endorse Bernie Sanders for anything, but I can say we support his bill for mm-hmm. Medicare for All.
Right.
And so that's our function, we talk. I'm talking to you.
Yes.
I talk at churches. I talk in union halls. I talk at schools. I'm going to talk to a group of medical students next week. So we do we're very grassroots too. Mm-hmm. So we'll be at the farmers market every Saturday. We work with other groups that do door to door.
Well, I know you've been visible in the community for a long time. I know mm-hmm. that.
Yeah. So we're out there. We are very grassroots. We try to organize. We focus on educating doctors and nurses. We focus on educating the populace, partly because the idea of Medicare for all is not necessarily easily broken down into little sound bites. Mm-hmm. Whereas the people on the other side who are against us, they've got to do really is kind of seeds of doubt and fear and uncertainty. Sometimes it's called.
Well, they've already done that by saying you can't choose your doctor. You don't have. You're going to lose choices as far as your medical care.
Right. Yeah. And so actually, I'm glad you brought that back up because I wanted to respond to that. So there's a lot of talk about choice. And right now, most people who are uninsured have no choice of doctor. And most people who have private insurance, for-profit insurance, are only given, really only have one health insurance company to choose from because they get it through their employer. Mm-hmm. And most employers now only offer a single coverage. There may be some levels of balance between how much deductible and how much premium, but basically just one insurance product. And then people on Medicare fall into two categories. People with traditional Medicare can choose any doctor. People with Medicare Advantage, which I'm not sure what you have with your plan, but if you have a Medicare Advantage plan, you may have limited doctors, but
yeah,
most insurance...
I've lost one doctor because he opted out of insurance completely.
Mm-hmm. So, most private insurance, including privatized Medicare, have limited doctors that you can see, limited hospitals that you can see. So I'm not a fan of that because I really think, and so I don't have privatized Medicare. I've got traditional Medicare. Mm-hmm. So if I get sick and I want to go to the Mayo Clinic, I can go. But people who have regular private insurance, generally, if they've got IU insurance, they're going to have limited doctors they can go to, and they're not going to be able to go to something like a Mayo Clinic, and it's usually going to be out of network for their insurance. And the doctors are going to be limited. They're going to have to change doctors sometimes. And if their insurance, and if their employer gets a different insurance company next year, they may have to change doctors again.
I've had to do that a couple times. And the fact is that I don't have choices, unlimited choices now.
Right. Yeah. So I think the choice, what people really want is people want to have the choice of doctor and choice of hospital. Mm-hmm. People do not really want to have a choice of insurance. They just want to have insurance they can count on.
That remains consistent.
Yes.
That you can also get information from. Sometimes they tell you they don't know, mm-hmm. or they need to have A, B, and C before mm-hmm. they can tell you.
Mm-hmm. It's terrible. And the parts of Medicare that are problematic now are dealing with the supplements and the Advantage programs. The traditional Medicare is actually pretty transparent. You can find out how much things are going to cost in advance. I'd like to get rid of the copays in traditional Medicare and get rid of the need to have any kind of supplemental policy. But the choice that people want is not, they don't want to choose an insurance company. In fact, they don't have much choice of an insurance company. Usually they have no choice, but they want to be able to choose doctors and hospitals.
What about, now see, dental care is something else that I've questioned. I mean, I pay a little extra so I can have dental coverage.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And would that be covered under Medicare?
So,
the
Medicare,
plan that you all envision.
What we propose would cover vision, hearing, dental. It would be comprehensive. And we've done the numbers, and it's doable.
I mean, I have some friends that live in Canada, and they said they pay $30 a year. For everything.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. That's
yeah.
what they pay.
It's pretty typical.
And they actually, coincidentally enough, use the same inhaler that I use.
Yeah.
And they only pay $10
yeah.
for theirs.
Yep. Yep. The Canadians have a system that is often slandered in the U.S.
Of course, because of the competition.
Because the moneyed people mm-hmm. in the United States love to slander the Canadian system because because if you understand how actually good the Canadian system is, then you start to question, oh, do I really need to be paying all this money to insurance companies that the Canadians don't need?
Well, people also seem to be afraid of going to clinics. Now, those people who aren't insured at all, they don't have any choice in doctors.
They have
you just
choice.
Show up at an emergency room or
right.
a clinic, and whoever's there is going to take care of you.
Mm-hmm.
I don't actually have that big a fear of going mm-hmm. to a clinic or, mm-hmm. You know, I like to choose my doctor because I feel like care is a little more adequate if they have a good background
mm-hmm.
on you, but
mm-hmm.
it isn't always essential.
Well, of course, you have the luxury of not having too much in the way of chronic diseases.
Oh,
now, if you have diabetes...
No, I don't. Yeah, that's...
You really need to see the same doctor.
Yes.
If you've got asthma and need inhalers, you can do that with sequential doctors.
Mm-hmm.
But if you have cancer, imagine...
No,
doing
I think
that
it's important
with
to
different
be able
doctors, to. Yeah. So
is your system that you would be able to choose your doctor,
mm-hmm.
or at least choose the same clinic with the same doctors? Because
mm-hmm.
I know that they're.
I mean, you have some limited choice doctors because some doctors the practice is full.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, so.
Maximum choice is the Medicare for All system that we propose has the maximum amount of choice of any other plans.
What would you
there.
See an ideal premium being for people if this actually
zero?
Zero, no premium.
Yeah, no. But we're going to pay through taxes, which are inherently much more fair.
What about
we all hate taxes?
Yeah, we do, but that's the way the government pays for things.
That's the way we. That's how we pay. For public education, that's how we pay for trash pickup and sewers, is through taxes. It's inherently more fair, even though we like to gripe about
mm-hmm.
it.
So taxes might increase. What about retirees? Because
mm-hmm.
taxes increase taxes is a little
yeah. So retirees,
a little more vulnerable.
Yeah, so right now, retirees, one of the weaknesses of Medicare is that it requires money from the retirees. And typically people pay for part of their Medicare by taking a deduction from their monthly Social
yes.
Security check.
Yes.
We want to get rid of all that. And again, we've done the numbers. We don't need to do that. So we're going to make it easier for retirees.
That sounds good. Now, how close are we to having any of this implemented? What has to happen?
Yeah, what has to happen? It's going to be some kind of a... We've had an incredible change in public opinion just over the last few years. Now, everybody's talking about Medicare for All. But we still face the pharmaceutical industry, the insurance industry, the device industry. The people who are profiting hugely now are understandably worried that their profits would be cut,
mm-hmm.
Would be reduced. And so they've got a ton of power. So I think... We've got the people, but they've got the money. And ultimately, if democracy works, then we can win. And if democracy is subverted and doesn't work, we can't win.
Well, don't doctors have some power? What about the AMA? Where does the AMA stand on, I don't know if you're a member of the AMA or not, but where do they stand on moving from the traditional system to...
Very interesting. So the AMA, or American Medical Society, American Medical Association, AMA, is still the most powerful doctor group in the country. It, the AMA actually has been a long time adamant opponent of Medicare. The AMA fought against the original Medicare program in 1965. The AMA actually hired a public relations firm that created the term socialized medicine. Ronald Reagan, before he was governor of California.
He was just wonderful.
Ronald Reagan, when he was still just an actor, was hired by the AMA to lead the public relations effort against Medicare for All when it first came up, before it was there was even Medicare under Harry Truman, and then against, he was hired but when Lyndon Johnson passed Medicare, but Reagan ran the attack saying it was going to be socialized medicine. Turned out, doctors' incomes went up tremendously after Medicare came in, and because, of course, all these old people who couldn't pay, are now they've got insurance and they're covered. So doctors did great under Medicare, but the AMA fought it. Now, in the days the AMA was fighting Medicare in 1965, the AMA claimed membership of pretty close to 90 90% of physicians. The AMA has withered since then. The AMA now only claims membership of about 20% of American physicians.
Oh, wow.
I've never joined.
I didn't know it had dropped that much.
I've never joined on principle. But I did join the Indiana State Medical Association, the state branch of the AMA, but I never joined the national organization because I was interested in trying to see what I could do inside the state organization. Mm-hmm. And I put some good years into it, and I was on the board of trustees of the State Medical Association. And I finally got kind of tired, but I got a little burned out. But
it's pretty political.
It's very political. But I went into the center of the beast and tried to change it from the inside, and I can't really point to any great victories there. But what's happened since then is really interesting, because the Student American Medical Association has become tainted by youthful political energy, influenced is a better word, but I chose tainted just to be provocative. The students across the country, medical students across the country, are coming alive with medical activism on this issue of Medicare for All. There's a group that just formed last year at the IU Medical School Bloomington branch called Students for a National Health Program, and they've got so much energy. And at the student AMA level, a group of students from around the country who are AMA members, student members, pushed the AMA at its annual meeting, which was this last summer in Chicago. They pushed the AMA with a resolution calling for the AMA not to support Medicare for All, but the resolution was forwarded calling for the AMA to drop its longstanding opposition to Medicare for All. And that bill did not, that resolution did not pass, but it came very close. I forget, it got 40-some percent, and the AMA was shaken to its bones by this just a few months ago. So as a result, then a few months later in the summer, the AMA withdrew from the big lobbying effort group that it was a part of called the Coalition for America's Healthcare Future. I may not have that exactly right. But something like Coalition for America's Partnership for America's Healthcare Future, which was a big, heavily funded lobbying group that included the AMA, the insurance industry, the hospital industry, and the pharmaceutical industry. AMA pulled out of that, so they have made a pretty significant change in their opinion. They haven't come out in favor yet, but they have pulled back. So things are changing. I don't know how it's going to get there. You know, you asked me, you know, how are we going to get there? It's going to take some changes.
I think we need a different government.
Well,
obviously, we need a different government.
It's not going to happen by fighting armed revolution in the streets. It's going to happen by changes in the government, and it's going to happen because people in both parties are going to have to support it.
Because I do have some hope for some of the young people, some of the new young people in Congress and the Senate. Boy, those people, I mean, when I look at those people, they're my age. Some of them are, of course, older. They need to be out. They are not in step with anything going on. And, you know, I always said Reagan was the worst president we ever had, ever had.
Till now.
Because I'm not even sure he understood anything. You know, he was a terrible actor, too.
Yeah, yeah.
And I don't think he understood anything, but he was somebody that they could push around and convince. And, you know, he started out as a Democrat. But he just, I didn't ever think he was very bright. He was just very good at delivering a message. Very good at making people, public feel comfortable.
Yep.
And everything's going to be okay. Daddy's got everything under control, you know. And boy, everything just has gone downhill since then in a lot of ways, I think. And so we need a new government. And we don't even have a president now, as far as I'm concerned. We have just somebody, a clown show. I don't feel like we have a president. I don't feel like we have anybody in charge of anything. And so it's very frightening to me. We really need some major changes, but it's got to happen. It has to happen. And I know you've been fighting it for a long time. How many doctors are involved in the organization that you're in?
About 20,000. So that's not an overwhelming number, but it's not an insignificant number.
Well, I mean, how many doctors are there?
You know, in the country, yeah, that's a number I should remember. I think there's 800,000, something like that. I mean, it's a tiny fraction of the doctors in the country.
Right.
We're growing.
Why do you think they aren't jumping on board? Do you think they're going to lose income? It doesn't sound like they would, given what you've mm-hmm. talked about Medicare.
Well, so why aren't more physicians involved? In terms of membership in the organization, I think a lot of physicians are just not politically active.
Yeah.
Now, polls of physicians have been taken, and the latest, and the polls are not necessarily the greatest quality if you kind of study the validity of polling, but it's interesting. The last two reasonably valid polls that have been released over the last few years have actually shown that more than half of physicians favor Medicare for All. Now, that was shocking to me each time I've seen that. Mm-hmm. And you got to look at things, how was the question asked or whatever.
Sure.
But I think on the one hand, my experience is it's probably less than half. Certainly the people I come into contact with, even in the liberal town of Bloomington. But there's a lot of, but physicians, the vast majority of physicians hate the current insurance system, hate private insurance dealing with them, and hate that they want to do things for their patients. They prescribe medicines for their patients can't afford to get them filled. Tests for their patients, their patients can't get the tests done because they can't afford the copays.
Or the insurance company won't pay for
or
that.
Or they get denied. Physicians really just want to take care mm-hmm. of their patients. That's why they're going to Madison. They want to make money, of course.
I know. But I said a few years ago, since when did insurance companies become doctors?
Right.
And since when are they going to make determination about my health?
Right.
I don't, you know, I was appalled as this began to encroach upon mm-hmm. us and limit our choices.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think, maybe there are a lot of people that don't pay attention, don't care, don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I think, I hate to say it, but I've said more radical things, is that I think we have a very undereducated population in this country. Under analytical.
Mm-hmm.
They don't know how to figure out what's really a fact, what's really mm-hmm. true, what's been proven and can be proven, and what's just been said. Mm-hmm. It's just gossip or a rumor, you know? Because I hear people talk all the time about, oh, this doctor and that doctor, and they told so-and-so this and that, and I'm thinking, no, they didn't. They didn't listen, you know, and they didn't know what to do with the information.
Mm-hmm.
And said, well, doctors should tell you more. Well, yes and no. Doctors are not supposed to be your educator.
Mm-hmm.
They can provide information based on the questions you ask.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I really think it's up to the public to take on some of this and learn something.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And make your job easier.
For sure. For sure.
Make your job
Absolutely.
A lot easier.
Yeah.
Kind of in closing, what do you want to say? What is your really firm message about all of this, about Medicare, and why you are so dedicated? I mean, I don't know how you have time to be a doctor. I really don't. Because you are so dedicated to this. And we need more people like you to jump on board, for sure. But what would you like to say in closing?
I worked for 28 years in the emergency room, mostly in Bloomington, but other hospitals.
Actually, you took care of me one time when I was in the emergency room. Yeah, I'm sure you don't remember. You've probably saw thousands of people, but...
And there was I did the math a few years ago, and in my career, I've seen over 100,000 patients. It's a lot of people.
Yes, it is. That is.
In the emergency room, I was on the front line, and I just saw it every time I worked. People would come in with a broken ankle they'd been walking on for a week and say, "Doc, is it broken? What do you think?" And I'd say, "Well, I got to get an x-ray." And they'd say, "I can't afford an x-ray." And you know, and they've been walking on this ankle that was, when they first injured it, it was probably just a hairline, but now the bones have shifted because they've been walking on it. So it was going to just need treated with a cast and some crutches. Now it's going to need surgery and a $30,000 bill because they delayed care. And the diabetics, oh my God. The diabetics, who now, I forget, the numbers are terrible. The number of diabetics in the United States of America, supposedly a modern, wealthy country, the number of diabetics who cannot afford their insulin and take half the insulin that, or less in insulin than is prescribed because they can't afford the insulin because the cost of insulin's gone so high. I think it's something like 70% of diabetics are taking less insulin than prescribed because the cost of insulin.
Well, and that's a death sentence.
It's a death sentence. It's an absolute death sentence. So there, it's no surprise that we have some of the embarrassingly poor healthcare statistics in the United States. We don't have anywhere near the best healthcare in the world, although we got the most expensive healthcare in the world. So we got to fix that. We've got to figure out how to take care of everybody.
We're supposed to be more compassionate and caring about people. I've seen the frustration in doctors. I mean, I have. Mm-hmm. I've seen some of them actually retire early because mm-hmm. they just couldn't deal with it anymore.
Exactly. Yeah.
I mean, how do you look at somebody and say, well, I'm sorry, I can't treat you, I guess. Mm-hmm. I have to let mm-hmm. you go out the door and suffer.
So the current system is unsustainable. It's wrecking our individual personal economies and driving us literally bankrupt. It's wrecking our nation's economy. It's too expensive, and there's too much money going for things other than healthcare. So inevitably, this whole healthcare bubble that we're on now is gonna collapse, and we're eventually gonna get to healthcare for all, because the rest is gonna be the only thing that we can afford to do. Now, I'm hoping we can do it sooner rather than later, mm-hmm. but I believe it is inevitable. There's no way around. We cannot afford to do what we're doing now. It's unsustainable. So we've got a plan that's all worked out, pnhp.org, that could cover everybody for less money than we're spending now. Quality would go up, life expectancy would go up, but it requires getting rid of some of the profiteers. It requires vastly downsizing and basically getting rid of private health insurance. And if you want to stick with this idea of a so-called public option, then you mean what you're really saying is I'm in favor of private health insurance because I somehow think politically I should be in favor of private health insurance. It makes no sense at all. Public option equals private health insurance stays in the system. We cannot save money, and we continue unsustainably for a country's economy and for individual economies. So public option is a terrible idea, but somehow has been pitched as a some better, easier idea. It's inevitable. We got to do it, and I just think we got to figure it out. I don't know how we're going to get there. If I knew that, we'd already be there, you know?
Yeah, right?
So we've got to just keep working. We got to keep talking to people. We got to keep educating people. We got to keep saying, yes, this is what's important. We got to vote for politicians who say we're going to cover everybody. We're going to really fix this.
Don't you think some of the people who are really support that public option are hanging on to it, I'm going to have to say, are just a little selfish and greedy? And they say, well, I can afford it, so why can't I have that choice? I can pay it. And, well, those people can't, well, they can get a job. We don't have much understanding or tolerance for people who mm-hmm. struggle,
mm-hmm.
who
mm-hmm.
don't have it all, don't, mm-hmm. and maybe can't get there. Maybe mm-hmm. they just, don't have the wherewithal. I think there's an awful lot of greed in this country.
Mm-hmm. And I agree with you, and I'm going to push back just a little.
That's fine.
because, yes, there's the greed. There's no question about that. But also, at first I can kind of get it. People say to me very sincerely, I really kind of want to take care of everybody, but I've worked hard and I don't want to pay for other people who don't deserve health care. So my reply to that is, tell me who doesn't deserve health care. Who doesn't deserve health care? Diabetics don't deserve health care. Some of those people have made really bad choices in life. And so I say, so when I was an ER doctor, should I have told the paramedics, should I have told my people in the ambulance service that if you get to the scene of a big multi-car accident, the first thing you got to do is find out who wasn't wearing a seatbelt, because clearly those people made a really poor choice and they don't deserve health care, and transport them last Instead of what we do now is we take the sickest people first and the second sickest people, sure, when you get a big accident. But if if somebody didn't wear a seatbelt, that's about as undeserving as you can get. You're saying if you don't wear a seatbelt, you don't even go to the ER, you just die there by the side of the road? And then, of course, the people say, oh, no, I don't mean that.
Some people might say that.
A few people, and those are the people I'm never going to get to.
Right.
But I want to try to reach some of these people, sure, whose first reaction is, I don't want to pay for people who don't deserve health care. I want to talk to them and say, so who doesn't deserve health care? So overweight people don't deserve health care because they've made bad choices? Well, I don't
people
know
that
about
drink
that.
Too much.
People, what about smokers? Oh, smokers make really bad choices. Okay, so here's another statistic. Over 80% of adult smokers who can't quit became addicted as children. Mm-hmm. In other words, they started smoking before they were 18. They became addicted as children because in our society we've allowed children to smoke, and we haven't taken quite enough steps to get people to not start smoking. And so I wish my friends and family members who smoke could and would quit. It breaks my heart that they're smokers, but I understand the power of addiction. And I understand that when you become addicted as a child, it's really hard to change those habits. So I will take care of smokers in my medical practice. I do.
The same with alcoholism.
Same with alcoholism.
Any kind of. People make poor choices, but they don't always make them consciously.
Yeah.
Sometimes people just kind of fall into something. And then there's the addiction pattern, of course. There's all different reasons for addiction.
Yeah. So I want to err on the side of taking care of everybody.
Sure.
That's what I want to do. That's what I want to do personally, professionally, politically. I want to figure out how to take care of everybody and then sort out later how I can change their behaviors to try to make them make better choices.
Well, I think one of the things people say, and we probably need to mm-hmm. end up here, is when they say, I don't want to pay for other people's health care, well, you are paying for it because of the emergency room costs. And people that do get things basically given to them, whether you call it welfare or whatever, you are paying for that because the hospitals and the medical services have to cover that somehow.
Yes.
And so they pass it on to the paying patient.
Yep.
And people don't see that. They don't see what isn't right in front of them.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Dr. Rob Stone, for coming on Talking With Me.
Well, thank you for having me.
I so admire what you do. Thanks. The energy you have, your conviction over the years. You've been at this a long time. And I do hope, I don't know if in my lifetime or in your lifetime we're going to see this happen, but as you said, it has to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope it does.
Thanks.
So thank you very much.
Okay, you're welcome.
And I hope you've enjoyed listening to Dr. Rob Stone on this edition of Our Outside View. And be sure to tune in. We'll have this posted soon.